Hi, this is Nicole, and you're listening to All Access Pass, brought to you by CITR 101.9 FM. We are located on the traditional and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. For this episode, I got to speak with a very special guest, Dr. Stefan Sunandan-Honish. He's a disabled lecturer in the theater and film department and is here to talk about his experience being and working in academia.
Thanks, Nicole. My name is Stefan Sunandan-Honish. That's my full name. My mother's from India. My father's from Germany. Ancestry is central to the kind of work that I do, how I position myself in the world. The short version of my educational trajectory, the reasonably short version, is I did my undergraduate degree at the University of Victoria in piano performance. I also took courses in composition. And then I did a double master's at the University of British Columbia in piano and composition. And then a PhD starting in 2008 and finishing in 2016. And then 4 months of postdoc work in Sweden. As a blind pianist, and that is one of the main themes or topics in my dissertation. I wrote about his visit to the University of British Columbia in 2013 as part of a series that I helped organize on disability in the arts. Gave a recital at the UBC School of Music and participated in a question and answer session. The dissertation focused in many ways on his visit to UBC, but I also discussed his 2009 shared gold medal at the Van Cliburn competition in Texas, which is in many ways pivotal to his rise to international recognition. He was already really famous in Japan and I think several other countries before the Cliburn competition, but it was really the Cliburn competition that pushed him onto the international arena in many ways. Just before the interview started, we were just talking about philosophy, and the reason I'm just referring to that briefly is for my dissertation approach. Actually, I tried something which I was complicated in a certain way, but I mentioned to you my interest in the work of Charles Saunders Peirce, the American pragmatist philosopher, and I did these interviews with Indu Nobisuji and then with professors and graduate students who were involved in bringing him to the University of British Columbia and who attended his recital at the School of Music. And what I did in my dissertation is to use Peirce's approach to semiotics as a kind of analytical framework to go through these interviews and to think about aspects of music experience in relation to disability that can be understood and systematically analyzed using a kind of Peircean taxonomy of sign types and interpretive frameworks. More accurately, because Peirce's approach to semiotics can be understood as a kind of single interpretive framework. And within that, he develops this incredibly complicated taxonomy of sign types based on the qualities of the sign, its relation to some object of our experience, and then how as we acquire more information about that object of our experience, then the interpretive act can unfold in different ways. So that was my basic analytical framework for the dissertation, and I've kept up that interest in Peirce's work since my PhD, basically.
Great. And the following question, feel free to answer in as much or as little detail as you feel comfortable with. How do you self-identify in regards to accessibility?
Question about disability and language. This is probably one of those questions that can't be decided one way or the other for everybody, because precisely because it does involve what I'm thinking of the distinction that Walter Ben Michaels makes between subject position and subject, for example. The point that he makes is that when it comes to subject position and perspective, there's no possibility for either agreeing or disagreeing, because it's a we're not dealing with any kind of shared framework. So all of that to say that my choice to self-identify as a disabled person rather than a person with a disability is part of that sort of ongoing and likely unresolvable difference between people with disability and disabled people. More recently, because of my work, my interest in political economy, I'm thinking especially of the work of Martha Russell, a disability activist and scholar who's written about disablement as a consequence of capitalist political economy. I've also, and then also because of my reading of Walter Ben Michaels' work, for example, I've also started to think twice, as it were, about whether or not the extent to which I want to focus on questions of identity and self-identity, which in many ways are questions that gained in according to some recent scholars, for example, those kinds of questions about identity have coincided with rising economic inequality within the last several decades, since the 1970s, let's say. And so as society as a whole, became more unequal, the interest in identity and difference and subjectivity as a way, in some cases, to skirt around dealing with material inequality. There's a kind of relationship between those two things. And all of that to say that part of my response to your question about how I self-identify is tempered by the recognition that I'm also rethinking not necessarily whether or not I self-identify as a disabled person, because to a great extent, I just experience disability as inseparable from who I am and how I move through the world. But the question and the importance of self-identification itself for me is something that I'm also questioning now.
Yeah, that's It's so true. It's such like a difficult question to answer, especially when you think about, and I'm sure you've like delved a lot into this, especially with your thesis, but self-identification is like a form of resistance, or like choosing not to self-identify is a form of resistance. So I really appreciate your thoughtfulness in terms of like why you may or may not choose to identify a certain way. Thank you. So I guess my next question is going to be, when you first started your undergrad, did you have a difficult time navigating entering a relatively able-bodied space as someone with a disability?
Experience as I remember it is that it was really a mixed bag. And it was really specific to context. And so, for example, when it came to working in the context of one-on-one music lessons, coachings with other music students, I think your question was specifically about my undergraduate. So my experience of disability was also changing in significant ways around that time. I was becoming a lot less mobile in many ways than I had been previously. And so that was happening. I was going through that evolution in my experience of being disabled, along with navigating this world of higher education, in which my experiences at the music school were very different from my experiences with public transit, for example, or with university housing, and with accessibility in the built environments outside the School of Music. One example, the School of Music at the University of Victoria, there aren't any, there are stairs to get on and off the stage when you're actually in the auditorium. But there's also a way to get backstage, which is just this corridor, and it the corridor has music studios on one side and then the recital hall on the other side. And to get backstage, it's by far the most wheelchair, certainly wheelchair accessible performing space I've ever been in. And so that heavily shaped my experience of being a music student and thinking about accessibility in a certain way and having a certain experience of accessibility specifically as a music student, but then having direct and frequent encounters with inaccessible environments away from the music building.
I'm very interested about, well, I don't want to commodify your life, but it's really interesting to hear about how your relationship with your body and your disability was also very rapidly changing during that time. So how did that kind of shift as you entered a master's? And I'm thinking more specifically in terms of when you start doing more rigorous kind of writing and reading.
The revisions, and I'm happy to talk about that later if you'd like. So there's this term that some researchers use somewhat humorously, but also maybe to make a point about certain types of academic research that focus, according to some ways of thinking, excessively on the self. So the term is me-search. Instead of research and a lot of disability studies scholarship. So I first became aware of disability studies as a field when I was finishing my under my graduate degrees in music. So this was 2007, 2008. 2006. And then I, my own first encounters with the field, and then with writing about my own experience as a disabled musician, that started in 2007, 2008. And I published my first two articles in 2009, and those significantly questions about my own personal experience as a disabled musician. And in many ways, that focus on personal experience has reduced over the years. And but there's still this sort of ongoing challenge for scholars, I think working in newer fields, especially about the relationship between the personal and collective experience, the ways in which one can write about one's own experience and then link it to larger concerns. If you'll permit me just a brief segue into my teaching, actually. So last year I taught this course on theater and political economy, and one of the works that we discussed in the course was a book by Nivedita Mojumdar, a scholar of postcolonial studies. And she wrote this book called Radical Universalism, Postcolonialism, and sorry, I can't remember the full title off the top of my head, but it's a critique of postcolonial scholarship in general for, in many ways, reproducing, even unintentionally, the kinds of essentialist discourses that it claims to reject. But specifically, she develops this concept of radical universalism as a way to think about and think beyond a kind of dualism between particular concerns and local contexts and universal collective issues that are of shared interest. And in many ways, that way of framing it is a central aspect of how I think about my own experience as a disabled musician, disabled researcher, writing about music and disability, teaching courses in theater studies and disability studies, that reducing the focus on my personal experience doesn't mean discarding it altogether, and sort of going wholesale, if you'll forgive the retail metaphor, or not retail metaphor, but the language of commodities and so forth. It doesn't mean rejecting personal experience altogether and just going purely for scholarship that leaves out the personal and strives for a kind of objectivity and so forth. There can be a way of mediating between the two and balancing the two, and that's ongoing as a source of interest for me.
Do you think that your struggle with where to insert your personal experience, or like not necessarily struggle, but your consideration, I think I want to say, for how to insert your personal experiences into your research is common amongst other fields of study that are maybe underrepresented in the field of academia? Like I'm thinking not just of disability topics, but also like gender and race topics.
Right.
Do you think that this is like something similar amongst your other academic peers?
I think probably, and possibly for multiple reasons, including the fact that there's often this assumption on the part of an academic discipline, you know, that scholars who are considered or held to belong to certain identifiable groups. So, in the case of disabled scholars, for example, will naturally gravitate to writing about disability or about personal experience. And in some sense, that's not a new source of consternation or indignation sometimes among disabled people. So Helen Keller, for example, I can't remember the article off the top of my head again, but in one of her writings, she complained that whenever she wanted to write about politics and social concerns and so forth, people either dismissed her work or tried to suppress her writing and thinking about those topics that extended beyond her personal experience. But when she wanted to, or when they pushed her to write about the subjective experience of being a deaf-blind woman, then any effort on her part to depart from that narrow set of expectations of her and of her work were met with a kind of indignation, often by her non-disabled peers. So, to some extent, I think that the question of how to locate one's personal experience in disability studies, for example, and then also gender studies, to cite the examples that you mentioned, there, I just have to acknowledge that I'm not versed in those fields, but certainly within disability studies, I think that the question of how to situate one's personal experience in the field is fraught and contested, both because of the concerns that individual disabled scholars might have about how to make their work widely relevant in relation to personal experience, but then also because that personal experience can be somehow claimed by outsiders who think that there's something inevitable or natural or just common sense about a disabled person writing about their own personal experience. That's also been part of a significant line of critique within disability studies that a lot of earlier work in the field, let's say in the late 80s and 90s, focused on narratives of biological impairment, for example, to such a degree that any analytical focus on societal barriers, the relationship between, for example, in Martha Russell's work, the relationship between capitalism and this disablement, those broader kinds of analyses were missing in the heavy focus on subjectivity, on highly individual kinds of experience.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. So as you transitioned from your master's into your PhD, and like this is gonna take a lot of considering the entire stretch of your academic career, so take your time with it.
Okay.
How do you feel that your ability to create meaningful change around accessibility has shifted with your like positioning as an undergrad versus your positioning as now an instructor and someone who holds a PhD?
Yeah, that's another really excellent question. Just for variety this time, so the question is excellent. And it's a difficult one to answer in any kind of comprehensive way, but I'll do my best. I think because the kinds of access supports and awareness of accessibility and so forth, and even the awareness of disability identity was much less prominent when I was in graduate school, even. And because, for example, when I came back as a postdoc and then as a sessional to the University of British Columbia, I realized that the university has dedicated spaces for disabled faculty and staff and students centered on disability justice. There's a disability affinity group, for example. There's an accessibility committee. These spaces allow for really robust critiques of higher education, research, and teaching in ways that I were not part of my graduate school experience. So in that sense, it seems to me that a great many things have changed for the better, and there's more scope for action and raising not only greater scope for raising awareness about access barriers and ableism and so forth, but also greater receptivity to raising those kinds of concerns compared to when I was in graduate school. On the other hand, this is where some of my recent engagement with questions of political economy really inform how I want to frame the sort of second part of my response to your question, which is that as a sessional instructor, so as contingent faculty, for example, and because of the ongoing search for stable employment and so forth, the capacity for acting in a broadly coordinated way with other groups to build solidarity, to build coalitions that organize around shared interests despite different lived experiences and so forth, that becomes much harder to do because of societal structures, economic conditions, and so forth that really go beyond questions of discrimination and really have to do with fundamental long-standing forms of inequality. All of that to say that while the scope for action on a more individual level or even in concert with smaller groups of colleagues, for example, while that has in many ways heightened and increased from the time that I was in graduate school to now as a sessional instructor, because the cost of living crisis has accelerated for everybody, pretty much in the intervening years, and certainly like within the last 5 years, all of that has in many ways also foreclosed the capacity for broad-based solidarity among marginalized groups. Doing something, for example, about the poverty experienced by disabled people in society, not only academics in higher education, but all across society, and then also the ways in which poverty goes beyond the experience of disabled people and is a part of the experience of so many people, and it cuts across discourses of it cuts across identity-based affiliations. And it's not clear to me how to achieve transformative or to push for transformative change when the scope for acting in anything more than a highly individualized way in which I encounter forms of ableism, for example, in my everyday life. And then I can draw attention to that in a fairly limited way for a fairly limited audience. But the larger structures in which that daily experience takes place, those remain intact.
Okay. Yeah. This is going to be my last question, and this one may be a little bit more out of left field.
Sure.
I don't think it will be. I think you'll handle it well, actually.
Okay.
As someone with a disability, in the field of academia, do you think you have any personal responsibility to make it a more accessible field?
I do. I'm mindful that that is probably the most concise response I've given you to this point in response to your questions. But I absolutely feel, or maybe a stronger way to say that in some way is I believe in the shared responsibility for addressing accessibility. So in responding to your previous question, when I expressed concern about the capacity to act in limited ways, and how larger forms of economic inequality are left unchallenged by the limited scope for action that exists. That's certainly not to say that that in any way reduces, for example, my responsibility to do what I can to provide more accessible or to make things better even in terms of accessibility for the next generation of students, for example. And I derive that set of beliefs from the principles of disability justice, for example, and the principle of collective access, for example, that working towards access is messy. It's dialogical. I don't know how to pronounce that. And it's open-ended. And it's always a shared responsibility. And also, more strategically, when everybody or as many people participate as possible in the work of in working towards greater accessibility and reducing barriers, then that benefits all of us. And when I reframed first, I said that I feel strongly about this, and then I reframed that as belief. This is what I believe to be true. If you'll forgive me for mentioning Peircean pragmatism just one last time, to the extent that pragmatism understands belief to be, as Peirce puts it, that on which we're prepared to act. So belief as something like guidelines or rules for acting in the world. That's why my inclination is to frame my response as one of belief. So belief in my individual responsibility, and then also in my responsibility to do what I can to find whatever opportunities exist to be in solidarity with others. To work for greater accessibility. So just because the existing scope for acting collectively and in solidarity is limited, that doesn't mean that my responsibility to try to find openings to do exactly that is somehow reduced.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for doing an interview with me.
My pleasure, Nicole.
Is the simple joy of riding a bike missing from your life? No worries. Ride On Bike Shop has got you covered. Ride On has the best deals in town for new and used bikes, top-notch servicing, and all the parts or accessories you've been dreaming about. Whether you've got a little one who needs to learn how to ride, or if you're about to go on the Tour de France, Ride On is the place for you. We'll also happily pick up your old bikes and recycle them back into the community. located on 2255 West Broadway. We are open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Tuesday to Saturday. That's RIDEON Bike Shop. See you there!
What a beautiful day.
Yeah.
Are you hungry? I think I'm hungry. I think we should get ourselves something nice for our beach day.
Oh yeah?
Oh my god, I know the perfect place. Cockney King's Fish and Chips is literally just around the corner. We should go there. It is the best fish and chips in Vancouver.
Oh my god, yes, absolutely. Let's go right now.
Cockney King's Fish and Chips, Kitsilano. On Cornwall Avenue, between Cypress and Walnut. It's the best fish and chips in town, but don't take our word for it. Try it yourself. If Kitsilano isn't your neighborhood, check out Cockney King's in Burnaby or New Westminster.
Feeling lost in the lonely, meaningless cyberweb? Looking to connect with other users? Then plug in to a CITR collective. Meet users who are compatible with your interests and passions. CITR's mainframe offers 9 unique collectives. News, arts, accessibility, sports, persons of color, indigenous, gender empowerment, LGBTQ2SIA+, and music affairs. CITR collectives are where you can make great radio, great friends, and avoid the abject loneliness of life in the cyber void.
Are you a writer?
Listener?
Dreamer?
Music nerd?
Want to cover artists?
Visit venues?
Write something?
Events?
Personal essays?
Anything!
Submit to Discorder magazine and then take it a step further on Hail Discordia with your hosts, Zoe
and Izzy. Hail Discordia is an audio translation of Discorder magazine. We interview writers, play music and soundscapes, and do a deep dive of each zine issue. Hail Discordia plays at 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on the third Thursday of every month on CITR 101.9 FM.
Submit something for the magazine and come onto the show, or just tune in and listen. We promise it's worth it.
What you're hearing is sound, the medium that glues together objects, spaces, and time. This is JS Horseman on CITR 101.9 FM.